We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our creator, not our government. I believe that scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Friday, March 28th. Happy Friday. And we need to talk about leftist violence, the response to the outcome of the election that clearly they don't prefer. Are they saying, well, hey, our institutions said that this is our process and President Trump was duly elected and he can get advisors like Elon Musk and we don't like it, but, you know, hey, this is America, as they wanted us to do with Joe Biden, where, you know, just sit back and take it. Well, their response has been to commit acts of violence at Tesla owners and also Tesla dealerships across the nation, and also swatting incidents against conservatives. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But Senator Marsha Blackburn has introduced a resolution that is condemning the violence on Tesla owners and dealerships. And she spoke with a Daily Wire's Morning Wire yesterday, talking about the purpose of this legislation. Listen to this.
Yes, we will take up my resolution, which condemns these attacks against Tesla. It should be on the floor of the Senate on Wednesday or Thursday. And what this resolution does is to say that the Senate stands against these horrific attacks of violence, destruction, domestic terrorism against electric car owners, charging stations, dealerships, maintenance facilities. I think it is stunning that we are seeing this take place and that Democratic leadership is not standing up and calling out these acts of domestic terrorism. We have lived through 4 years where every time you turned around, they were talking about domestic terrorism. They were calling parents that went to school board meetings domestic terrorists. They were calling individuals that would stand across the street from a Planned Parenthood and pray for the women and the unborn children, and they would call that domestic terrorism. And now we are going through this where they're actually firebombing and shooting up Tesla dealerships, and nothing is being said. So we think it's appropriate that we have the resolution and we give them the opportunity to stand up and say, we condemn these attacks.
And interestingly, and that was Senator Marsha Blackburn talking to Morning Wire yesterday, interestingly, I have not seen a single Democrat condemn the swatting incidents. Of course, swatting is to call a local law enforcement with a pretext of a crime being committed or some other reason to send armed officers to a person's home or place of business for the sole purpose of having violence potentially occur. And there have been a number of conservatives targeted through these swatting incidents just in the last few weeks. One of them is Larry Taunton. He is an author and columnist with contributions to USA Today, First Things, even The Atlantic, Spectator, a lot of other publications. And Larry, I've seen the video of your swatting incident. I mean, this is scary stuff. This is something that should never, ever, ever happen. And so describe what you went through and, you know, what types of consequences people who call in these fake reports should face.
How are you, Jenna? It's always great to be with the lovely Jenna Ellis. You know, I was just with you about 6 weeks ago from Rome. And I'd just been at the World Economic Forum, and then I had this run-in at Cairo, And then all of a sudden, I'm at home. It's, you know, it's 1 a.m. My dog Ranger, my German Shepherd, whose instincts I've come to trust, would not let me go to sleep. Was kind of agitated and trying to let me know something was going on. I get up, I draw my gun, Jenna, and I go out into the darkness of my kitchen, and I look out the window, and I see three men. I can't tell that they're wearing police uniforms. I see three men with AR-15s tiptoeing around on the deck of my porch. They'd come in silent, no sirens, this kind of thing. It is attempted murder by proxy. And by that, I don't mean that the police officers themselves, you know, were out to murder me. Rather, I mean that the individuals who are doing this, they seek at the very minimum to terrorize conservatives. But, you know, the intent was really to kill me. And if my wife got killed, or if I had, you know, children in the home, or police officers get killed, so much the better. These people are terrorists, and they should be prosecuted as terrorists.
I agree with you, and I've seen that call and for justice, and also the condemnation from a lot of Republicans, including, you know, Senator Mike Lee and other very prominent figures. It's really fascinating to me that the Democrats somehow can't condemn these incidents just because they're against conservatives. I mean, that's heinous. It's low. It's frankly reprehensible. And why can't Democrats at least agree on that?
Well, I mean, we're dealing with individuals, Jenna, and you know this. You know this as well as anyone because of the things that have been done to you personally. But these are people who care nothing for the rule of law. They care nothing for our Constitution. They don't even care about America. They're individuals who only care about the acquisition and preservation of power. And they are willing to do anything it takes to gain it, to preserve it. And thus they're using, you know, Marxist, Saul Alinsky, Nazi 1930s, you know, brown shirt, you know, kind of tactics. This is what they do. It's terror. What I would want to say to people is this, though, Jenna. I want to say it to you personally. I'd want to say it to anybody who's listening to us. I am energized by this, because to me, this is, I never saw The Exorcist, but I've seen enough, you know, little memes and this kind of thing, that it feels to me like we're at that part of the movie where the cross has been revealed and Linda Blair's head is spinning and projectile vomiting, meaning the demon is being driven out of, that is embedded throughout our bureaucracy. And they are doing absolutely everything they can to try to hold on. These are the fact that you would SWAT my house or someone else's house, a lawfare, this kind of stuff, is because you've got nothing left. You've got no arguments. You got nothing left. And we intend to beat you. We intend to beat all of you because you're evil people. And that's just the way I see it.
You know, I think that's a great perspective, especially from someone who went through this horrific incident. And by the way, you can see the videos that Larry has posted on his X account at Larry Taunton and see, you know, what exactly was going on from his security cameras. And it's a great perspective to say that when the left resorts to violence, like they did in 2016, like they did even in 2020, like they are now, it's when they are so angry that truth is winning, and that conservative policies are winning, and that their opposition is winning. And instead of perhaps making better arguments, you know, like Jasmine Crockett, right? Who's like the leader of the Democrat Party,
exactly.
Which is hilariously absurd, right? If that's their best spokesperson, they're clearly losing. Yes. Then they resort to violence because they have nowhere else to go. And yet, I don't think this is going to be, by any stretch, the last gasp of the far extreme left, they will try to push their worldview, as strongly as possible. So, I mean, where does it go from here when this isn't going to work? And hopefully the people who are responsible for these incidents will be brought to justice. Pam Bondi, Kash Patel, I have great faith in them and, you know, obviously the men and women of law enforcement around the country. But, you know, what's the breaking point?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Jenna. You know, when you were reading my, you know, byline very kindly, you know, I've done work. I never worked for them, but I worked as a freelance that was occasionally the conservative brought into, say, The Atlantic or CNN or those kind of places. And that was pre-2016. I don't get those invitations anymore, but I enjoyed that because at that time, I mean, I would always say, look, to the people who like my work, who support my work, you want me in as far left as I can go. That is to say, in those venues. I want to be in those venues, not just preaching to the choir, but I want to go after the people who I'm not afraid of disagreement. I would love to go on CNN and just go at it with the best people they have on topics where I feel that I'm credible. But you see, now they don't do that anymore. Now they just want to shut you down. They don't want to give you the opportunity to speak. They don't want to hear your arguments. They don't want to publish you anymore. And that's because they're afraid. And so for me, I would just say, look, if you are getting pushback, if there's been an effort to intimidate you, and you know, maybe somebody listening to us, Jenna, they're not people, say, with platforms where they're getting swatted, but maybe they've been denied a promotion or marked off the party list, or you know, there's been some other kind of softer persecution. Press on, because it's an indicator you are, to use the phrase of the day, over the target. It's an indicator. You know, and that term comes from, you know, bombing runs, you know, World War II, where you knew you were where you were supposed to be when the flak, you know, the air was filled with flak from anti-aircraft artillery that was there to protect the thing you were sent to bomb. If you weren't getting that, it meant you were out over a pasture. Nobody cared. So, you know, the fact that we're getting this pushback, to me, it just indicates we have to double down. We have to indicate to these people, we're not afraid of you. I won't use the word that I think you people are. I think you're cowards to come after me, you know, like this. I've debated Muslims who just threatened to kill you. And I just think, you know, that's kind of refreshingly honest, sort of straightforward. These people are cowardly. And I think they've grossly underestimated who we are in what we're about. Not only that, Jenna, I want to throw this in. They're bad terrorists, because we're all left thinking, you know, wondering, what was it we said they don't like? Is it my commentary on Ukraine? Is my support of Trump? Is it USAID that I've worked to expose for their corruption? I mean, good terrorism, effective terrorism, it's clear what it is they don't like you saying. Right now, we're kind of wondering, what's the connection between all of us who have been swatted? We don't really know.
Yeah, other than obviously being conservative and not extreme crazy leftist. So on that front, congratulations. You know, you're not one of the crazies. So, you know, that's a badge of honor in that sense. But I like that response. And it is cowardly, especially to use law enforcement in a attempted murder by proxy. I think that's the right way to describe this. You know, so these are people who aren't even willing to do the dirty work themselves. Yeah, and they're not willing to even have an argument. They're not willing to advance anything. They're just chaos creators, and that's it. I mean, this is the heightened and far more criminal form of a whining toddler who is screaming and who is utterly absurd because he's not getting his way. And this just shows the devolution of a society that, when you don't have the appropriate view of government and authority and principles and all of these things, these are the types of people that intentionally want to create chaos. And so I think we're going to see this heightened in different ways throughout the next 4 years. But I have confidence that we will be able to handle this as a society in a way that, as you described, Larry, just kind of looks at it and just says, okay, you know, you took your best attempt here and you're not getting anywhere. We're not going to change our position and cower to you and your ideas, because that's what they want. They want to instill fear in their victims. That's always the way. And we should always respond without fear and with truth. So last 30 seconds, closing thoughts.
Well, I'll just say this very quickly. I was listening to your intro there, and you were talking about a Christian worldview, and then you were just now talking about the devolution of, discourse in our country. Listen, what we need is a revival in this country, because authentic conservatism is rooted in a Christian worldview. To be anti-woke doesn't make you a conservative. Muslims are anti-woke. As authentic conservatives, our worldview is rooted in the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and that's who we are. That's what we're about, and we need to press forward and quote Joshua 1, be strong and courageous.
Amen. Well, Larry, thanks so much for your thoughts, and I'm glad that you are safe. We'll be right back with more to talk about First Principles. As we celebrate the many pro-life victories going forward, we rejoice. Preborn's network of clinics have a unique opportunity to advance even further without political persecution. But what does this look like? Preborn is the greatest threat to the abortion industry by rescuing on average 200 babies' lives a day, and they are putting a serious dent into the abortion holocaust. But there are still thousands of babies who are slain daily, and Preborn's goal is to rescue them all. With the help of the pro-life community, meaning you and me, we can save so many more. Please join us in saving all of these precious lives. The ultrasound is the game changer. Once a mother hears that precious heartbeat, she is twice as likely to choose life. If you consider yourself pro-life, we need your help. One ultrasound is just $28. Five ultrasounds are $140. $5,000 sponsors ultrasounds for the entire Preborn network for an entire day. So how many lives can you save? Every child is a beautiful gift from God, so please join this cause. To donate securely, please dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, let's turn to House Resolution 271. This is the Defund Planned Parenthood Act of 2025. And so the summary, according to Congress.gov, is that this bill restricts federal funding for Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Inc., or any of its affiliates or clinics for 1 year. Specifically, it prohibits providing federal funding to those entities unless they certify that the affiliates and clinics will not perform and will not provide funds to entities that perform abortions during that year. So let's welcome in Ryan Helfenbein, who is the Vice President of Communications for Liberty University and also the Executive Director of the Standing for Freedom Center, and one of my favorite people to rant with, especially on a Friday. So good morning, Ryan. And I think this is an excellent start.
Yes, I do too, Jenna. Good morning to you and happy Friday. You know, this is something that many conservatives, and I would even say those who are on the other side of the aisle, there are people who maybe they don't choose abortion for themselves personally, but maybe they might be leaning more pro-choice. This is a majority issue where many Americans will agree that they do not want to see their personal tax dollars being used to promote or provide abortion services, which is ultimately the ending of human life. It is the killing of an unborn child in the womb made in God's image. It is an industry built on carnage. It is the culture of death. It is based on a brutalistic philosophy and worldview. But we're talking something north of $700 million or more a year. This is a multi-billion dollar industry, lest we forget. Planned Parenthood has been around for a very, very long time, and they have relied upon federal dollars to come into their coffers and support their mission of death. That's exactly what they're doing. They do not provide health care services. That is 99% of what they do, ultimately, is abortion and the ending of human life. And so I'm very glad to see this. I will just say it's a good first step. It's not enough. We're just talking about for 1 year. So there's a moratorium on that. There's an ending on that. We definitely need to see more and more action on the issue of life. But we should absolutely not be funding this industry. It is a for-profit industry.
Yeah, and well said that this is a good first start, and it seems kind of arbitrary and really temporary to just have this for 1 year. In your estimation, is this just to kind of get the ball rolling and then to say, okay, this has been a year and look at, and then we have kind of more of the facts that Planned Parenthood and its affiliates attempt to hide to suggest, well, you know, abortion is so minimal of what we do. We provide other, you know, healthcare services to women when obviously if they can't do abortions that are funded by the federal government, then, you know, some of these clinics would close. I mean, and so is the target really to try to just get to the truth of the matter and then move on from there? Or, you know, why isn't this at least for, you know, the 4 years of Trump's term, or even for the 2 years of this current 119th Congress?
Yeah, I think this is all about incrementalism. I think you're spot on, just in the question and the framing itself. I think you're exactly right. Just like tariffs, which again, these are not supposed to be permanent actions. This is leveraged temporarily. This is trying to sort of boost American industries, whether it be the auto industry, steel industry, aluminum, you name it. In a similar case, this is about incrementalism. You know, since June 24th, 2022, when the Dobbs decision was handed down, there have been numerous defeats at the state level that have come along because of messaging on abortion. This is about, you know, fundamentally, you know, changing whether it was on the ballot in Ohio and other states across the country, which is hardly a lib state when you consider, you know, the Republican majorities that are in the House and the Senate there, the state House, state Senate, governor. But there are lots of folks that, based on messaging from the pro-abortionist side, have been misled on these issues. I'm even thinking recently in your home state of Florida, Jenna, that it was narrowly defeated in Florida. But if you'll notice, I think it was 57% of the vote on Resolution 4. It did not pass, but you still had north of 50% on this particular issue. So I think that this is a temporary measure incrementally to see what they can get. And I am all for it. You know, I'll just say this: I am absolutely an abolitionist when it comes to the issue of abortion and protecting and defending life from the moment of conception all the way up to natural birth. I am for protecting life. I'm for ending abortion. But realistically, we deal in a world where we need a dose of biblical realism, recognizing the space that we share with common citizens that have a different worldview. And we've got to do things that make sense in order to move and push that Overton window on life. So while I started out saying, hey, majority of Americans are not in favor of using their money to support abortion, there are a majority of Americans who would probably lean pro-choice when it comes to other people having the so-called right to choose. And so I think it is important that the conservative cause on life be smart in this process. And I do think that even these temporary measures, it's something. It's not the whole loaf, but it is a slice.
Yeah, and you're right, Ryan Helfenbein, to point out that even though Florida defeated Amendment 4 last fall, it was really only, I think, for two factors. One, because Florida has one of the highest thresholds for citizens' initiatives or ballot initiatives at 60%, and it was very narrowly defeated. And so if we'd had a 50% plus one, like a lot of states do, it would have passed. So that's very concerning. But also because Governor DeSantis is a great leader and got involved and was educating people on exactly what this amendment would have entailed, not just this so-called, you know, right to choose and, hey, let's leave it in the hands of mothers and doctors who know best. I mean, this was all about abortion tourism. This was about state-funded abortion and other things that people don't agree with. And so I think you're absolutely right to call out messaging on abortion, because Governor DeSantis, in talking about this, and I was very involved in that campaign because I care about this, obviously, but also because it's my home state. But he made the point during that whole attempt to defeat Amendment 4 that even Republicans and conservatives aren't necessarily pro-life, like you and I would attest that the biblical worldview requires. And that disconnect, I think, is where we are facing the difference between well under 50% or the 57% that Florida experienced. And so how can we bridge that gap and message this well, instead of just talking about, you know, periods of gestation and, you know, some of these other things that aren't really as emotional as how the left frames their argument? We've seen that the pro-life generation and all of the medical advancements like the ultrasound, the heartbeat, I mean, preborn, which is, you know, one of our sponsors of the podcast version of this show, they always have success that women will choose life when they hear their baby's heartbeat. That's a powerful tool. In addition to that, though, I think we need to be talking about other things like the pressure from families, from boyfriends and husbands, for women to get abortions, and all of these other reasons that are actually very emotional. Sometimes when women who have an opportunity to choose, and unfortunately that's still legal in some cases and circumstances, they do choose abortion instead of life. How can we bridge that gap and message so that even Republicans and conservatives aren't saying, well, you know, maybe I wouldn't choose that, but I don't want the state to restrict the liberty of someone else to choose abortion?
Yeah, it really does come down to making these strong appeals, not as abstractions, philosophical arguments, but these are rooted ultimately in the heart, in emotion, because emotion can move people, and emotion is not always a bad thing if it's partnered with truth. 3D and 4D imaging has certainly gone a long way in making that strong case and that strong appeal to young women mothers who have a baby. They can hear that heartbeat. They can see the movement. They can also recognize very quickly that a child in the womb can feel pain. And that's important. It's important to acknowledge that. It's important to know, too, that in the gestation period, in the period in which a human life is developing in the womb, a child is developing, that a heartbeat comes very, very, very early, as early as 6 weeks. And so, you know, you're hearing, I think, the beating heart 15 million times by like week 15 or 16, which most states have statutes that abortion can't happen after week 15. But we know that that's way late in the period of human development. But I think it's about this. You mentioned women being pressured into abortion. Absolutely. They're pressured by men, but they're pressured also by greater society. I think it's also the flip of that is that women are isolated in this decision. We know that no child is born and no child is conceived without a mother and a father. So there is a father. And it's important to recognize that in our hyper feminist society, that we have relegated that only to a choice among women, where fathers have no say. And so I think it's where churches need to stand in and stand up and lean in. And I also think that it's important that we develop and raise up a godly generation of men who can also speak up for life. And so often when we are talking about pro-life platforms across the country, they're led by strong and courageous women. Praise God for that. But we don't see a lot of men. And so I think pulpits in America can do more. I think churches can do more. They do a lot. Crisis pregnancy centers, you know, there are three times as many crisis pregnancy centers as there are abortion clinics across the country. So they do a lot. But in terms of messaging, I think it's time for men to step in and speak up even more. There is a rightful claim of fathers upon the life of that child. And it's not just a mother's choice.
And I think all of those socioeconomic and sociodemographic and community pressures need to be factored in to the messaging. And this bill also does provide some exceptions. And I think this is the elephant in the room, perhaps, Ryan, that the pro-life Christian community doesn't necessarily like to address head-on, because this this bill, this House Resolution 271, says that the bill's funding restriction does not apply to abortions performed in the cases of rape or incest, or when necessary to resolve a physical condition that endangers a woman's life. This would be like an ectopic pregnancy, for example. And there are mixed opinions on this. I know some Christians who would say that these exceptions are reasonable because the life of the mother is also obviously a life and very important. And then there are some that are full abolitionists. And so what in your view is the biblical worldview argument of how we need to address those questions? Because the left loves to run to the, you know, less than 1% of cases that, you know, almost never happen. They don't want to talk about the abortions for convenience or the pressured abortions, you know, some of those. They like to go to the most extreme and honestly some of the most tragic cases. How should we respond?
Yeah, I think so. In the case of rape and incest, great question. In the case of rape and incest, you already have a situation where a crime has been committed. I think that you punish the father in that scenario, but the child should not bear that punishment. And I think that's where, when it comes to a Christian worldview, the answers can be right, but that doesn't mean the answers are easy. And so the right answer can be the most difficult one. That child should not, that the life of that child should not be ended in the case of rape and incest, because that child still is made in the image of God, regardless of the circumstances of that conception. So it's important to recognize that as Christians, we are on a mission of mercy to rescue that child. That child can be given for adoption. There are families that will take that child, love that child, receive that child, just as it is their own. And the abortion arguments are trying to gear towards those rare exception cases. And that oftentimes gives away the entire farm. In the case of, the jeopardy of the life of the mother, I don't have those. Susan B. Anthony and other groups have those statistics, but we're talking about a very narrow 0.001%. There are people who have died, women who have died in the birth process, thanks to many modern medical technologies, and of course, thanks largely due to cesarean deliveries, the mortality rate during birth has dropped dramatically in the past 100 years. There's a lot of medical advancements, and also premature babies, NICUs, and other types of things are able to take that child very, very early in a pregnancy. And bring that child to full development, and they go on to live very healthy and natural lives. So much of the abortion arguments are an appeal to myth and irrational fears. And that's what they're trying to do in order to stir up angst and to get folks on their side. And so it really comes down to truth versus lies. And I think that we have to understand we believe in the truth, but we also speak the truth, and we should not live by the lies of the left on the case of abortion.
Yeah, and I think that is very well argued and coming from a position of truth. And you're absolutely right that the left likes to go to those emotional situations, and we as Christians need to be prepared for those questions and to answer them truthfully, but not just statistically or factually, without understanding that these are complicated questions and they are very emotion laden, of course. I've seen, and I've even personally experienced talking to some friends who genuinely are concerned that if the pro-lifers have our way and we get basically full abolition of abortion, that some women's genuine health services, like Life of the Mother, for example, would just be totally overridden and their ability to access healthcare and, you know, some of those other things will be diminished. And so we need to argue from a place of compassion, from humility, from recognizing that these are complicated issues, but with truth. And like you, Ryan, the law, I believe in the case of rape or incest, for example, the law never punishes an innocent third party for the crimes of another in any other scenario. And in fact, we take great pains when we're talking about justice and a well-ordered society and the state enacting justice and mercy to understand that it applies to the perpetrator. And so, yes, a horrible, unfathomable situation occurs where there is a rape or incest, even when it doesn't result in pregnancy. But when it does, the crime is the rape itself. It's not the pregnancy. And so then what happens when a woman is already pregnant then at that point, and the state should at that point step in to protect the life of the child, because that unborn child has the same right to life that the mother also has and has the same protections of due process and the right against the death penalty being imposed without due process from the state or allowing the taking of that life when the child is innocent of any wrongdoing. And so we need to think through these things critically and biblically. And when we're talking about scenarios that endanger a woman's life, you know, these are things. Well, I always ask this question, Ryan. I always say, why does it have to be one or the other? Because when we're talking about in a scenario when a woman's life is at risk, and often they'll say, well, you know, a woman's been diagnosed with cancer and she can't receive chemotherapy and all of that while pregnant, and so they need to evacuate the fetus, which is a nice way of saying killing the baby, so for her to receive that health care. Why not say in those situations, we now have two patients and we need to figure out the best plan that will mitigate the cancer as much as possible while not threatening the life of the child? Why can't we come up with better solutions than immediately going to the easiest solution for the left to argue for, which is, well, of course, abortion is the solution in those circumstances. Just like unwanted pregnancy, if it's unwanted, the easiest solution is just throw it away. You know, why can't we have more complicated answers and more nuanced answers to these problems without saying, well, if you advocate for the life of the child, you're not advocating for the woman. And so obviously we need to advocate for the mother's life because that's valuable. But what the left is implicitly arguing is that the child is not valuable. Why can't we have those conversations?
Yeah, I think that there's two things happening simultaneously. I love how you phrase that. Two things happening simultaneously. In the one sense, there's public policy, there's statutes, there's law, there's, you know, what's happening medically in terms of the treatment of a patient or a mother who is pregnant. And so there's all these kinds of practical implications in every decision. Then there's the spiritual arguments, and there's the recognition of things coming down to worldview and you know, who made us and in whose image are we made, and ultimately why do we exist, and these big questions of life, philosophical questions and spiritual questions. Certain things can be answered where you can point to the natural, and then there's other times in which there's never going to be an answer that satisfies unless it's answered spiritually. And I think that's one of the things that's often missing. The culture of death and those who advocate so strongly for abortion, it's not just about the ability to be emancipated or the ability to be liberated, a woman's right to choose, to have total possession of her own body. It goes further than that. It's ultimately about the suppression of truth and unrighteousness, that there is a God to whom we are accountable. And our life came from him, and the life of that baby also came from him. And I think there's a lot of folks out there who they're willing to listen up to a point, and they don't want to hear that. because ultimately, if that life in that womb belongs to God, that means your life belongs to God, and that means that you will be accountable to Him for the decisions and choices you make in life. And so I think that's difficult for some people, simply because they don't want to submit to God's will. That's the challenge. I want to go back to something really, really fast. I was able to look this statistic up, and it's 0.033% of the number. It's like, it comes out to about 32 out of 100,000 pregnancies. 32 will end in the death of a mother. And that's where these are life-threatening situations medically. And it could be a whole host or variety of reasons. It could be preconditions. It could be other kinds of things that are leading to a life-threatening situation for a mother in pregnancy. But the false dilemma is often being communicated there, where it's either or. Either you can have a dead mother, or you can have a dead baby. And that's how the left wants to communicate when it comes to the issue of life. They want to present a false dilemma. And in the same way, the abolition, the scaremongering, and some of the abolitionists do this to themselves, actually, but the scaremongering is, well, we don't want to throw, first of all, we don't want dead mothers. The other thing is, we don't want mothers in prison for these choices. And oftentimes false dilemmas are presented there. These are scare tactics that the left uses because they do not want to see abortion ended.
You're absolutely right, Ryan. And this is why we need to be firm in our beliefs with our knowledge of the person of truth, Jesus Christ, and what he commands, and be prepared to give an answer for the hope that lies within us before we even begin to address some of these policy questions, so that we can rightly divide truth from error and we can advocate in a way that is consistent with truth and the biblical worldview, and point out and identify the false dilemmas before we even engage those arguments, so that we aren't caught up in the traps of the left. But we're going to need to take a break right here, and we'll be right back with more with Ryan Helfenbein right after this.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, welcome back. And Ryan Helfenbein, who is the Vice President of Communications at Liberty University and also the Executive Director for the Standing for Freedom Center, is still with us. And Ryan, in this closing segment, and I wish we had more time to talk about this, so maybe we'll have to do a podcast episode and a deeper dive. But when we're talking about the things of truth and being centered and focused on Christ first, identifying that worldview, then contemplating policy and law, the question in an American context often arises, and I was ranting with Steve Dace on the program yesterday about this, with the rule of law in the Constitution and fidelity to the rule of law, and that's, you know, the greatest principle in America. We often overlook what actually underpins and grounds the Constitution in its legitimate authority or its legitimacy. That is derived from the authority of God himself as the divine lawgiver. And so in any society, whether, you know, you're a constitutional republic here in America or any other nation and government institution across world history, any sovereign nation, we can say their government is being legitimate or illegitimate, or is exercising a good or false authority based on the principles of Scripture and authority that comes from God himself. And if we go back to Genesis, I mean, original sin started with a discounting and a turning away from and a rebellion against God-ordained authority. And that's where, when we're talking about whether it's abortion or we're talking about these runaway judges who are imposing their political will on, you know, Trump's immigration stuff, I mean, all of these things really can go back to, are we submitting to God as the source of authority, all authority, Or are we rebelling against the ordered authority that he establishes in Scripture, which includes the institution of government? Because God ordained, of course, three spheres of government: church, family, and civil government. And so civil government can operate legitimately or illegitimately, but that's not just based on whether you're Republican or Democrat and that sort of malleable standard. It's ultimately rooted in divine authority. And I think we forget that sometimes. So let's talk about authority from a scriptural context.
You know, it's interesting. I love this discussion because it's really, really important that when you go into the Torah, the first five books of the Bible authored by Moses, we see that after Genesis and after the patriarchs and after slavery in Egypt, the Israelites wandered the desert for 40 years. And what God was doing was he was giving them the law and giving them instruction. He was laying down a foundation, not just for a spiritual people of God, a kingdom of priests that were set apart as God's chosen people, but he was also laying down the foundations of the kind of government they were going to have. And many people throughout history have looked at that period before there was a king in Israel. In fact, Judges begins with this time of chaos in the land, and they said there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. But in the Torah, in that time in which they were wandering around in the desert and they were being fed the mammon and loaves of bread from heaven, right? They were being instructed by God. This was referred to as the Hebrew Republic. God was laying down his instruction for the kind of king that they were to have. And that king was a delegated authority, not an absolute authority. And he ultimately had to be surrendered and submitted to God. And our American Republic, in the way the founding and the framers of the Constitution, how they wanted to do that is a separation of powers, a segregated and delegated authority where there was no one power that was fully vested in with all authority, but instead you had an executive branch, you had a legislative branch, and a judicial branch, and all of them had different roles and responsibilities. And what's interesting is in this current paradigm, Jenna, you've seen this sort of runaway judiciary in which judges are trying to circumvent and they are trying to create obstacles, legal obstacles from duly elected officials, including the president of the United States, who in Article 2, you see the scope of executive power and what he has rightfully been charged to do by the Constitution. One of those is to protect the borders. And you see this runaway judiciary that is trying to inhibit that ability to do so. But it all goes back to what we see in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 17, what is the role of the king? It's to uphold the law. He's not above the law. He's under the law, and he's the keeper of the law. And it's interesting that in our present context, we see a similar thing with the president. He's not a king, but he does have executive power, and he is to uphold the law. And we're seeing all kinds of obstruction happening and obfuscation, lies, counterpoints, things like that are happening. This is counterproductive to the health of our democracy, of our republic, actually. And we have to go back to some semblance of order when it comes to law.
Order, absolutely. And a well-ordered society means, by definition, that we need not just a rule of law that bends with the will of whatever society happens to say today is right versus wrong or is constitutional versus unconstitutional. And, you know, the Constitution's a living, breathing document. Well, then there's no predictability in law. There's no foreseeable consequences to the law. And so ultimately, Ryan, we have to, as you said, we have to go back to the original intent. We have to go back to the proper authority. We have to be a well-ordered society that cannot happen without a grounded, fixed standard in moral truth and virtue. So we'll have to continue to talk about this topic. We're already out of time for this morning, but Ryan Helfenbein, so appreciate you joining on these important topics. Listeners can follow him on X at @rhelfenbein. And you can, of course, go to Liberty University's website, Standing for Freedom Center, see all of the great things that they push out. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Make sure you're listening to the brand new episode that drops today of On Demand, the AFR exclusive podcast, where we're doing a deep dive into the economy. You can find that at AFR.net. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.